Welcome, everybody. This is the fourth lecture of our course, Money, Monopoly, and Market Intervention. This is the fall of 2011, and we're working through the third section of Man, Economy, and State, and specifically tonight, we're focusing on the second third of Chapter 11. Since these last three chapters are so big, we're breaking up 11 and 12 into chunks of three. And Matt has just posted the URL in the chat box if you're watching this live to get the PowerPoint show, if you want to have that locally. So as you can see, we've got a ton of material tonight. If I'm going to plow ahead through. If we get through all this, then we're all caught up in terms of the assigned readings, because before we fell behind. But if we get through all this tonight, we'll be back right on schedule. Let me just say, this is sort of exciting in a geeky way that for those of you who have been following these issues, people like Robert Wenzel and so forth, he was on the Peter Schiff show talking about Herman Cain's 999 plan, that sort of thing. So we're not quite there yet, but in Chapter 12, Rothbard goes through and gives a taxonomy of government intervention and goes through all these different types of taxes. So it's kind of neat. We're not just learning this stuff just for our abstract knowledge of poetic analysis or something. I mean, it's to be able to correctly analyze and say, well, what do these mainstream economists mean when they talk about a consumption tax or a sales tax being better than an income tax, blah, blah, blah. We're going to have the tools to do that, and also Rothbard takes the analysis in ways that are pretty novel, that a lot of mainstream economists just focus on one or two things, and then Rothbard brings up these other issues that even most mainstream economists, if you said, well, what about these considerations, they would probably say, oh, yeah, you know, normally we don't talk about that, but you're right, that's something we should worry about, too. And it's really just interesting, and we're getting to that pretty soon. But anyway, the stuff we're doing tonight's interesting, too. Okay, so obviously there was a lot of material, so I'm going to just highlight a few 10 things, obviously, because there's 10 on the PowerPoint, but just go through and hit some things to make sure, because a lot of it's self-explanatory, but I think these are areas where maybe you're not going to get what Rothbard's saying, so it'll help if I walk you through it. Let me just say one more time, I said in the beginning of the course, if you are going to have the time to do the reading, it will be a lot better for you, and you'll get a lot more out of it if you can do the reading first before I talk about it. All right, so for a lot of these things, I'm not explaining the stuff from scratch. I'm halfway assuming that some of you have read it first, so just keep that in mind. Okay, so Rothbard talks about, at one point, the speculative demand for money, and that's kind of a weird concept, so let me just make sure you get what he means there. It's not... I don't mean it's weird that Rothbard invented some weird thing. I just mean it's hard to think about what would it mean to speculatively demand money. So whenever you get tripped up like that, when you're talking about the demand for money and things seem like they're getting flipped around, just first think of it as a regular commodity. Like, what would it mean for a speculative demand of a regular commodity in this example? And work your way through that, and then do it with money, and then just realize the one trick with money is usually the prices are always going to be the opposite of the way they are if you're talking about any other good, because the price for any other good means how many units of money do you have to give for it, whereas with money, the price of money is how many other commodities do you have to give up for it. So that's the one thing that's a little bit tricky. But other than that, the analogy holds, because money is a commodity. And that's really the neat thing about the Austrian approach. We don't really give any special privileges to money. It's not that we have a different theoretical apparatus when it comes to how people value money and how do you determine what the supply and demand of money are. It's the same tools we would use for the supply and demand and valuation of oranges. I mean, there obviously are some differences, but it's mostly in terms of little applications. It's not that we have a whole different framework the way some mainstream economists would. Okay, so speculative demand, what would it mean to say, you know, think back if you've been with me throughout this whole book, think back to when Rothbard was just generically talking about demand. he broke the analysis up. At first, he was going just from people's value scale rankings, like if it were something like oranges, based on your preferences to hold oranges as a consumer good. And so then Rothbard, you know, drew those demand curves out and talked about them and what they meant. But then he said there's also a speculative demand. And if you remember that part, he was showing how the speculative demand can alter what the regular demand curve looks like. And he was saying, because what's happening there is how many oranges you think is a good idea to buy right now when they're $5 a pound, that's influenced, yes, by your underlying preferences and you know, how much, like, do I enjoy eating oranges, or could I use it to make orange juice if it's really cheap, that, you know, that kind of stuff. But also your expectations about what orange prices are going to be in the future. So if you maybe I should switch away from orange. That's going to be a little bit contrived. Let's talk about gasoline. That's easier. So speculative demand for gasoline, what would that look like? I can ask you what's your regular demand curve for use of gasoline, and I can say if you're driving to work and you see the pump prices, $2.50 a gallon, how many gallons are you going to buy? And we can go through and I can pull you and try different prices. But if it were really cheap, like what if you were driving and you saw that some place for some reason was selling gasoline at 1 cent per gallon, and you didn't have any doubts about the quality, like you didn't think it was a scam or something, and really they were just giving you water or something like that, like you, it was legitimate gasoline that was that cheap, you might even, depending on your what kind of equipment you had and things like that, you might load up on it intending to resell it next week when the price came back, because you're thinking there's no way this can last, that the price of gasoline is 1 cent a gallon, this is a mistake, these people are foolishly basically giving it away, I'm going to go load up, not even just for your own use, but because you're going to sell it later on, right? So there, the quantity you would be demanding, if we observed that and plotted it in terms of your demand curve, would be huge, and it would be a lot more than even you personally could use. The way to see the difference is if gasoline were 1 cent a gallon and you thought it was going to stay like that forever, that, you know, there was some technological breakthrough, Martians came and showed us how to turn water into gasoline. And so now, you know, all you had to do was put a little filter on the end of a water hose, and then unleaded gasoline would come out of it if you just turned the faucet on. So now gasoline would be almost free. You wouldn't go get, you know, huge barrels of, you know, from your shed and then go to the local gas station and fill up and then go and store it in your garage, just like you don't do that with gasoline right now, probably, okay? Because even though it's real cheap, you would just fill up your tank and then just think, okay, this is great. I can go spend my money on other stuff now, because now for the rest of my life, it's going to be almost free for me to fill up my gas tank. But you wouldn't totally load up on gasoline right then if you thought this was forever. Whereas if for some reason this anomaly, for some reason this retailer is selling gasoline at 1 cent a gallon and there haven't been Martians, and you just know that's, you don't know why they're doing it, but it's crazy, but okay, then you might go to Home Depot and get a bunch of huge containers and go and buy thousands of gallons of gasoline, you know, assuming you thought you could store them and they wouldn't blow up your house. Okay, so You get the distinction there. So there, it's a speculative demand that's being laid on top of your sort of underlying fundamental demand. I don't remember the term Rothbard uses, but there's a, you know, the regular demand that doesn't have speculative motivations involved, but the actual demand, all things considered, includes speculative demand. All right, so it's the same thing with money. So remember, there is a demand to hold money. And it's a weird thing that you have to just get used to, but just do it through introspection. That when you go to the ATM, what are you doing? You're not taking out money just with specific purchases in mind. You say, you know what, I'm going to spend $32.67 at the grocery store tomorrow at 4 p.m., so I better have that amount of money in my pocket for when I walk into the grocery. That's not the way you do it. You like to just have a certain amount of cash on you at all times, and if that gets low, then you bolster it. Of course, if you have specific things that you're going to go to a ball game or something, you'd load up on cash. Or if you're going to go travel, you might load up on cash. But you get the point. Even in your normal day-to-day life, you like to have cash on you, even though you don't know what you're going to use it for, because you might need it for something. So that's the regular, normal demand to hold money. But on top of that, there's a speculative demand that what if you think the price of money is going to go up in the near future? What would you do? You would load up on money now. Just like if you thought gasoline, its price were going to go up in the future, you would buy more of it now. You would acquire more of it now. So it's the same thing with money. So if people think the purchasing power of money is going to be higher in the future, right now they increase their demand for money to get it while its purchasing power is relatively low. So it's like they're buying low in order to sell high. But we're dealing with money. So the only thing that's tricky there is the prices go the opposite way of what you're normally thinking of. So to say the purchasing power or the price of money is going to go up in the future means regular prices of everything else quoted in money are going to go down in general, meaning right now people are willing to offer more to get money, so that what that means is they're more reluctant to spend money. And so, or people who are selling everything else are willing to accept lower prices. So supply curves, regular supply curves, what shift to the right and push down the market clearing price quoted in money. So, and demand curves shift left because people who have money don't want to give it up as easily. And so if supply curves are going right and demand curves are going less, the market clearing price goes way down. All right, so that's what happens. So prices in general now start falling if people think the prices in the future are going to be lower. So it just speeds up the adjustment. So here, there's nothing peculiar to money here except which way the prices go. Just like if we, you know, think back to that gasoline example. If for some reason the crazy retailer is selling gasoline at 1 cent a gallon, that situation is not going to last because speculators are going to see that and they're going to rush in and buy and clean that place out. And so the people who are selling at 1 cent a gallon, first of all, they're going to say, whoa, our sales are way up. Maybe they're going to raise the price. But even if they don't, they're going to get cleaned out. And then the gasoline is going to be in the hands of people who know this is nuts. Next week it's going to be selling for whatever, $3 a gallon. So we're not going to, you know, we're going to keep buying until we bring the price up to at least that right now. So it's the same thing with money. If everybody, or if many people for some reason thought a year from now prices were going to be 50% lower than they are right now, people right now would start hoarding cash. But then by them doing that, that would push prices down now. So it would just speed up the price adjustment. So Rothbard has this neat phrase where he says, with money, as with other commodities, the actions of speculators are self-correcting, not self-fulfilling. So here, it's a subtle little phrase. And he's got this diagram, so let me first of all explain what he means, and then I'll show you how he's trying to illustrate with that diagram. So his point is that with regular commodities, normally people who are fans of the market will say speculators have an incentive to speed up price adjustments. So if they think that something's undervalued, if they think a barrel of oil is undervalued, right now it's selling at 60, they think that in the future it's going to be selling at 80, what do? They buy it now, so that pushes up the price. And so it speeds up the price adjustment. Other way around, if they think it's overvalued by the market, then they sell it, or short sell it if it's a stock or something, and that selling pushes down the price to speed up the price adjustment. So that's what Rothbard means by something being self-correcting. The idea is there's a correct price that matches up the fundamentals, if you will, And then if for some reason temporarily the actual short run market clearing price is different from that, then speculators come on the scene and move it towards where it ought to be. So some people claim that that mechanism doesn't work with money. And they said with money, it's just a self-fulfilling prophecy. If everybody thinks the purchasing power of money is going to be 50%, or if they think prices are going to be 50% lower next year, that will come true because everybody will hoard his cash and the prices will go down, and then next year we'll get here and we'll be right. Prices will be that much lower. So the claim was that with money, there's no correct in the absolute sense of the term purchasing power. It just is whatever it is because of convention. And if people collectively can start thinking it's going to be one thing, they're going to be proven right. And then, you know, it'll confirm it. So that's what, so Robert says, no, that's not true. It's true you can move purchasing power that way because of people expecting it to go that way. So that is true. But then once we get there and the speculators have no reason to stay in the market or to act on those beliefs and arbitrage opportunities, then the original fundamentals will reassert themselves. So with this diagram, he's showing we have this original demand for money, and then this thing is the stock. So it intersects here at point A. So originally, if you go from A to the left, this height right there, that's the purchasing power of money. And then Rothbard says, well, what if people collectively just all of a sudden think that in the future the purchasing power of money is going to be higher, but it really shouldn't be that high? That it's just the people underlying subjective preferences in terms of the utility of cash balances and so forth, that hasn't changed. It's just, what if somehow this society collectively gets this notion in their head that the purchasing power of money is going to be a lot higher next year? Could they just move to that new equilibrium forever because of this quirky, you know, sunspot thing? And Rothbard says no, because it is true you could temporarily do it. That because people think the purchasing power of money is going to be higher in the future, that makes the demand curve for money shift to the right, to this dotted line. And then that does push down prices. You move up to this new equilibrium point F, which has a purchasing power of E for money there, which is higher. But Rothbard says that's unsustainable because this demand curve here was not a demand, was not the, I forget what terminology he uses, it's not the demand curve derived just from people's preferences about holding cash balances because they want to possibly use them to buy things. That this dotted demand curve was influenced by the speculative demand. And so once now that E, we get to E, the speculators don't want to keep holding on to that extra money. They want to get rid of it. And so they spend more, and then that pushes prices up, meaning it pushes the purchasing power of money back down. And so then the speculators, once that happened, if they were good speculators, they'd realize, oh, wait a minute, the purchasing power of money is dropping now, so that would speed up. People would really try to get rid of their money fast as they realized that not only am I carrying more money than I personally would like to if I thought things were stable, but on top of that, prices in general are going up. So I'm really going to get rid of my money fast now, my excess cash balances. And so then that would just speed the movement of the dotted line back down to the solid line. So Rothbard's saying even with money, there is a sense that there's an objectively right, stable purchasing power for it to have, given everybody's subjective preferences, and that speculators will tend to move the purchasing power in that direction. So really what's happening here is Rothbard just admitting you could have bubbles in the price of money, but that ultimately speculators will act to pop the bubbles, just like with any other thing. So, you know, with housing, if everybody were sure that next year home prices would go up 50%, they might. You know, that would make people rush to buy houses. That would push up house prices. and then that could continue for a few years. But the point is prices were way above what could be justified by the fundamentals, that if, you know, in terms of if you took away the speculative demand, what would the supply and demand be, and what would the price be? If the actual price is way above that, so that we could loosely say, oh, that asset's in a bubble, that's a very precarious situation. And once it turns and starts going down, it deflates very quickly, because then the speculators move in the other direction. Okay. So the next thing I want to talk about is clearing and credit transactions. That, and I have this picture of the bar here to show you, hopefully it'll jog your memory. It's a mnemonic, right? A credit transaction, I mean, yes, banks engage it and so on, but we talk so much about fractional reserve banking and the Austrian tradition and so forth, that, and that gets tied up with the creation of money, that I think when you're just trying to think of what is credit, don't think of a bank first of all. Like, get down in your head what credit is first, and what money is first, or second. And then the third thing you want to do is then think about banking, because with fractional reserve banking, those two things get blended together. So conceptually, what is a credit transaction? It's just a transaction that involves present goods being exchanged for future goods. And so the person that you think of as issuing credit or granting credit really is just a person who's giving up present goods for a claim that somebody else gives to future goods. And so that's why there's the issue of credit, meaning, you know, can I trust this counterparty is actually going to come through in the future and give me the thing? As opposed to a spot transaction that's not a credit transaction, where I give shoes to the baker and he gives me bread, there's no issue of, oh, is his credit good, or do I need to grant him credit because I'm just exchanging the good. But if I give shoes to the baker in exchange for him saying, I'm going to give you a loaf of bread every week for the next year, well, that's mostly a credit transaction, because I have to trust that he's actually going to come through with that promise. All right, so that's what credit transactions are. And then a clearing operation is where you typically, what happens is, you'll have a period of time and you'll have credit transactions occurring. So you have different parties who are exchanging goods, but they're not settling up at the moment of exchange. They're not spot transactions. It's somebody will buy something from someone, but not actually give him the money for it right then, or give him, if it's a direct exchange or even indirect exchange, what the other thing is, but will say, okay, you know, I owe this to you in the future. And then with what happens with clearing is, every periodically what you do is you look at those different accounts and you just cancel stuff out, or you clear it. So if over the course of a month I go into the, and so the reason I have the bar here is just think of it as running a tab, if you're familiar with that concept. I don't know in people from other countries what phrase you use to describe it, but in the United States, let me type it out, make sure. It's called running a tab. And so you'll go into the bar, for example, if the bartender knows you and you don't have the money on you, and you say, oh, you know, give me a drink, and he puts it in front of you, okay, that'll be $5. You say, oh, put it on my tab. So the bartender might have a sheet of paper somewhere with your name on it and write down that, okay, that's $5 that you owe us now. Okay, and then you just keep, they just keep track of it. So there, that is a credit transaction. Now, the bar is not a bank. They're not creating money. It's not that M1 or M2 or M3 in this economy went up because I said to the bartender, put it on my tab. No, the bar doesn't have the ability to create money. But they are issuing credit in a sense, because they're allowing me, they're giving me present good, the beer, and I'm promising to give them future goods, namely units of money at some point in the future. And so you get the element too where they need to trust me. So that's the sense in which I have to have good credit with them in order for them to be willing to do that. And if I'm, you know, if I have really good credit with them, they might be willing to let my tab go up to $10,000. Whereas if I'm a stranger and just coming off the street, they might not give me, you know, a credit limit of zero. Or if I'm just a regular person that they know fairly well, maybe they'll say, after it gets to be $100, maybe they'll say, okay, Bob, we're not going to give you any more credit because right now you owe us $100 and we're starting to get nervous that maybe you're not going to pay us. Okay, so you see how all those terms work, even in the simple example of a bar letting you run a tab. So the thing with the clearing would be if the bartender now happens to like my economics lectures, and so he goes to my consulting firm and meets with me, and I talk about the economy, or he asks me questions about his business, you know, hey, Dr. Murphy, can you explain, should I be worried about commodity prices going up and the price of wheat going up and so forth from some of my beers? And I go, you know, and put on some bogus economist show to bamboozle him. And so, and I say, oh, that's going to be, you know, I'll charge you whatever, $20 for each presentation. And I don't actually take money from him. I just write it down on a piece of paper. Okay, he came on Tuesday, so he owes me $20 for that. He came on Thursday, he owes me another 20. And then periodically we just settle up. Like every month, let's say, at the end of the month, I add up his account and say, okay, you owe me $840. He adds up the sheet of paper that he's been keeping track of mine, and he says, and you owe me $810. So then we clear it and then say, on net, he owes me $30. And then he opens his wallet and he takes out $30 in cash and gives it to me. So what's happened there is, or what Rothbard's getting at, and Mises has brought all this up in the theory of money and credit, is that when you have the development of credit transactions and then coupled with clearing warehouses and so forth, or houses, clearing houses, it can greatly economize on the actual use of money. And so it reduces the demand to hold money. Because notice in that example, if the bartender and I didn't grant each other that credit and we didn't use the clearing, well, then we would have to have, you know, depending on the timing of our different purchases, possibly hundreds of dollars more in cash that we just kept passing back and forth if we had to settle up with every transaction. Whereas in practice, what an example I just gave you, the whole month's worth of transactions we facilitated by only having $30 between us that was necessary to consummate that month's worth of transactions. So if we're doing that with more and more people in our community, then over time we actually don't need to be carrying around that much cash because we hardly ever use it, or at least we don't use it as much as we would if we didn't have all these arrangements with people and didn't have short-term credit. So that's one of the points that Rothbard was making in this section. Let me just also mention, in case some of you are getting confused, when I talk about the demand for money, I usually, and I speak as if what I mean is pieces of currency that are in your wallet or your purse. And I'm doing that on purpose to make sure you understand that the principles we're talking about apply to those things. But they also would apply to checking account balances. So when I talk about the demand for money, it's not merely, or, you know, like Rothbard and Mises would not merely mean the demand for actual currency that you have on your physical person, but they would also mean how much you have in your checking account balance, because you can use your debit card, or you can go to an ATM, or you can write a check on it. And that's, you know, it's called a money substitute. And that's in most applications where you would need a $20 bill, it will be almost as good or just as good to have your debit card that you can swipe. Right? They're not perfectly interchangeable. There are some situations where you don't want to have to write a check or use your debit card. So that's why you still have actual cash on you. But just keep in mind, when we talk about the demand for money, depending on the application, we might mean that in a broader sense, and we're talking about how much of your wealth do you keep in your checking account, not just on your physical person. Okay, Rothbard talks, or he walks through this diagram, so let me explain this to you, but also point out there's an interesting little footnote, or not a footnote, but a, I don't know what you call it, a little warning, a note from the publisher, which is the Mises Institute, that underneath this diagram, so this diagram on the left is from Rothbard's textbook, and the and there's a little note under it, I don't know if you caught it, that says, this is the Keynesian cross, and this is not how Keynesians typically label their axes, the X and the Y axis, or axes. And then it says, if you want to understand why Rothbard changed it, go see, and then it points you to something in chapter 12, I think. So just so you understand what's going on, I just want to make sure you get this. This thing on the right here, this is the actual Keynesian cross diagram. And so notice the y-axis is called aggregate expenditures, and the x-axis is called income, or y. And then, whereas Rothbard's diagram, he just calls both of those things money income, which is a little bit weird. This thing, all these things are weird. I never really got this. I mean, I can explain to you what a Keynesian textbook would say, but I'm just saying the idea of graphing something in this way always seemed a little weird to me, and it still seems weird to me. But you might say, what is Rothbard even showing here? That you're graphing, you know, normally you graph and you say, like, oh, on the x-axis that's time, and on the y-axis it's weight. And so then the line is, what's my weight as a function of time? And so if it's going up, that means I'm getting heavier. If it's going down, I'm getting lighter. If it's a horizontal line, that means my weight's constant. You know, so that, normally there's different things on the axes, whereas here, Rothbard has the same thing on both, and then he's got a 45-degree line, and he calls it something else, which is kind of just, so anyway, I'm saying that in case you were puzzled about these things, not in terms of the economics, but just in terms of the graphing of it and the math behind, like, what does that even mean if you've got two things on the X and Y axis, and then you've got a line that's something else but similar. I'm explaining to you part of what's going on is the Keynesians have different things, but Rothbard doesn't like what they do here because this is problematic too. So I guess I'll tell you the way the Keynesian would talk about this, and then I'll tell you what Rothbard's problem is, and then I'll talk about Rothbard's diagram. All right, so this thing on the right here, this is called the Keynesian cross diagram, and you would get this. I don't know if they still teach this, to be honest with you. This would be like old school 1950s Keynesian textbook stuff. I don't know if the modern ones even have this anymore. But on the y-axis, it's aggregate expenditures. So that's how much people in the economy are spending in total. So it's aggregate demand. Whereas the x-axis is total income. So it's confusing. This y here, that doesn't mean the y-axis. That means y, like y equals c plus I plus g plus net exports. So that's what that y is doing there. That's not the axis. So this 45-degree line, remember the 45-degree line, what's special about it, that's where X and Y are always equal in terms of graphing. These points are all points that have the same, you know, 5, 5, 6, 6, 7, 7. That's what's special about the 45-degree line. So that means if you anywhere on this line right here, what's true is that those are all points where total spending in the economy equals total income in the economy. Because, you know, the Y height is the same thing as the X width. is economically, that's got to be true, ex post, that however much gets spent is how much the income is. That's the idea. That's you know, one of the central insights of Keynesian macroeconomics is that one person's spending is somebody else's income. And that's why they think there's a fallacy of composition. If everybody tries to save more, thinking they're doing the smart, frugal thing and getting ahead of the game, they end up causing a recession. Because if everyone tries to save more, everybody's income goes down, or so they claim. So that's what's special about this thing. Now they've got this other line. What the heck is this? This is aggregate planned expenditures. So here the idea is they're making a distinction between what people want to do, what their plans are, and then what ends up having to happen. So they're saying the individual household has the famous consumption function where as your income goes up, you consume more, but it's not one for one because you say your marginal propensity to consume is not 100%. So for every extra $100 that you make in income, maybe you consume 95 of them and you save 5. So your marginal propensity to consume is 0.95. And so that's why this line here has a slope that's less than 1. Because this is showing what happens to planned expenditures. They're going up with income. As we move to the right, this line goes up, but the slope is less than 1. But also, notice even if income is 0, so that's what happens over here, right, that you're on the x equals 0 width. But the y is positive, or aggregate expenditures is positive, right? So the intercept is not at 0, 0. It's at 0, comma, some positive number. And that's because they're saying even if you're a household with no income, you still are going to have some expenditures that period. You're going to run up your debt because you got to eat. Maybe you got to pay the landlord or something. So that's where the slope and the intercept of this line come from. And then they're saying, but in practice, aggregate planned expenditures have to equal actual expenditures, to get into equilibrium. It can't be the case that households collectively plan on spending more than they actually do time after time. Like eventually, the expectations and the plans have to come into accordance with reality. So just like you couldn't keep, as a household, you couldn't keep planning on spending $100,000 year after year if your actual income is $80,000. So that's why they make them intersect. That's what's going on with this intersection. They want to say if households are planning on doing this, if this is the relationship between households' planned expenditures as a function of their income, where does that equilibrate? Where is it self-fulfilling or where is it internally consistent where given how much income they're actually making, they plan on spending enough such that that's the income. And the trick here, too, is not just by a per household thing. It's fine. It's not that every household has to expend its income every period because some households save in the way the Keynesians do that. But the idea is in the aggregate, it's got to be true. The total expenditures, meaning consumption and investment, and if you're if you have a government spending and so forth, has to equal total income every period in the aggregate. There can be deficits and surpluses among any individual unit, but in the aggregate, it's all got to balance. So that's what's special about this intersection point. So that's the idea. So Rothbard doesn't like that, and that's why he didn't carry over these axis titles, and he just called it money income. And so one of his problems was, if you looked ahead, as the publisher's note told you to go check it out, one of the problems Rothbard has is he doesn't like the handling of the chronology here, that Rothbard thinks of it as everybody in the economy gets an income in period one. Then they say, what are we going to, how are we going to spend it? And then their decisions cause the total income in period two. And then you do it again. And so now in period two, all the households have their actual income. Then they make plans about how are we going to spend it. And then when they go ahead and do that, now in period three, we know what everybody's income is again. All right, so that's, whereas here, they're making it look like it's simultaneous, and Rothbard doesn't like that. So that's one of the main problems he has. Okay, anyway, now back to what's Rothbard doing with this thing. He wants to show, let me do one last thing with this, with the cane being set, because I think it's easier when you can see that these things are labeled differently. Because with Rothbard, to call it, well, it doesn't matter. It's the same thing. But over here, do I want to do it? Actually, I think it makes more sense over here. Sorry, I keep flipping back and forth. I'm trying to think of which diagram it'll be more intuitive when I do it. I think actually over here. So this is probably another reason that Rothbard changed it. Because he's trying to keep the timing consistent. So here, now he's saying, so this thing is social income, and then this is social expenditures, and he's saying, all right, what, okay, we understand the sense in which this intersection point is an equilibrium point. It's a, where if we ever got there, it would be self-sustaining. But what would push us towards that equilibrium if we weren't there in the, to begin with? So let's say initially we're over here, you know, at this level of money income. So what happens? So here, at this level of money income, social expenditures are down here, and income is way up here. So the point is, if income is this high, aggregate income, then people don't want to spend that much. And so the fact that they're not willing to spend that much means that's going to contract total income next period. And that's going to be true all the way down to this intersection point. At which point, you know, what's special about that intersection point is that's where total social spending equals total social income. And so that's consistent. On the other hand, what if for some reason you found yourself to the left of that intersection point? Then you see over here, social expenditures are higher than social income. And so that's gonna make income go up next period, because people are spending more now than their income is. And so the total spending equals the total income for next period. So that means total income's higher next period. And that is true all throughout this region, wherever social expenditures are above social income until we finally hit that point. So what's the big deal with all this stuff? Rothbard says, well, the deal is, because, you know, he said, okay, you know, it's a little bit weird to talk about aggregates like that and so forth, but, and he's not too comfortable with how they treat hoarding as like a leakage out of the system. And but, you know, putting all those objections aside, what's wrong with this? You know, what's the big deal? Isn't this just showing how we determine equilibrium, and that's where the economy goes to, and that's what total nominal income is? Like, what's the big deal? Just like if I drew a supply and demand curve for potatoes and said, oh, if the price of potatoes is too high, there's a surplus, and that tends to push the price down. If it's too low, there's a shortage that pushes the price up, and only at the magic equilibrium intersection point does quantity supplied exactly equal quantity demand, and that's stable. You know, after I got through all that, you'd say, okay, that's good, but so what? You know, what's the big deal? Why is that a problem for the macro economy? And so the problem is the Keynesians say that there's this full employment level of income, which on this diagram he's just depicted by this vertical line FF. So the Keynesians say that wherever this social expenditure line is, or what they might over here call aggregate plan expenditures, wherever that thing intersects the 45-degree line, that's going to pin down the equilibrium level of total nominal spending. But we have no reason to believe that that's going to also be the level of spending that gives us full employment. If it happens to be like it is in this diagram, where the intersection point occurs well to the left of this line, then we're at an equilibrium. The economy is perfectly content to sit here, even though maybe unemployment is 20%, because people aren't spending enough to employ all the workers. And here was the contribution of Keynesianism, and this is stable. You know, so the classical economists thought, if people aren't spending enough to employ the workers, and there's 20% unemployment, and the workers all want to work, and they just, you know, they just can't get hired for some reason, well, that's not stable. The wages are going to fall, other prices are going to fall, something's going to happen so that the economy ends up moving to a market clearing point where the labor market clears. But the Keynesians are saying, no, look at this line here intersects this 45, and that's going to keep it right there, but oops, it's below this level of full employment, so the economy's stuck there. All right, I'm not going to take on the critique of this right here because Rothbard defers it himself. So we're going to come back and blow up that kind of thought process, but Rothbard doesn't do it right here. He just had some quibbles about some of this stuff, but he doesn't totally go for the throat right here. So we'll postpone that. All right, another topic that comes up in this in these sections is what's called money illusion. So here, let me just go over it quickly because this is something you should know what that means. So money illusion means, broadly it could mean anytime somebody is fooled by the difference between nominal wages and real wages. People are asking in a question, that's Andrew Jackson, that's from a $20 bill. And so I Googled Google image search for money illusion. I was assuming there would be like an optical illusion involving money that would be, you know, funny in a pun, and this is the kind of stuff that was coming up. So that's some celebrity. I don't know if it's Julia Roberts or who that is, but they superimposed Andrew Jackson's head on hers. Okay. So what money illusion means in the context of economics is when people get fooled by the distinction between nominal, you know, meaning absolute dollar amounts or euro amounts or whatever the money is, versus real variables, meaning once you adjust for the purchasing power of money. So the classic example of this is that a lot of Keynesians thought in the 1930s, what was happening is that workers were not, the wages were rigid downward, money wages were. The workers would not accept an explicit pay cut. And so that's why we had unemployment was so high, was that workers, you know, the wage workers were being paid was higher, or it wouldn't have made business sense to hire the unemployed workers at the going market wage, given what the prices of everything else were, because the productivity wouldn't have justified it. And so a classical economist might have said, well, okay, so wages need to go down, but workers were not willing to accept lower wages because of unions or whatever. But for whatever reason, money wage rates could not go down. But a solution was, what if we printed a bunch of money and that pushed up prices in general? And so workers didn't get raises, or they got raises that weren't as high as the general price level was going up. Then effectively businesses would be lowering the real wage they paid workers, so that would make workers cheaper, and so businesses then would have an incentive to go hire a larger quantity. And so that relied on money illusion. It was that if you think that's going to work, you have to believe in money illusion. You have to say that workers refuse to take a 5% pay cut, but they're okay continuing to go to work for their original paycheck, even as prices go up by 5%, even though that seems like it's the kind of the same thing. So why are they willing to do one but not the other? And you know, the way economists summarize that is to say, oh, they suffer from money illusion. So just to warn you, nowadays, all right, there's two things. One thing just to be careful about is if you say, oh, so the solution then even from a Keynesian point of view would be if you could get workers, if you could break up unions and get workers to lower their wage demand, that would solve everything. Paul Krugman's going to say no. That, and there's various reasons for why that won't work, according to him. So it's a little bit awkward where you think, you thought, oh, okay, you guys are saying the market failure is wages can't go down, and that's why we need to run the printing press to get back to full employment. Well, wait a minute, why don't we also just break up the unions and lower wages directly? And then they say, well, no, because that's not really the problem. So it's a little bit, they have models where that everything they say makes sense, but I'm just warning you that just be careful. They're going to think you don't know what their position is. And then the other thing is Keynes himself and then many of his followers think it's rational for workers to behave this way. So just be careful. So typically free market economists and certainly Murray Rothbard thinks that you're assuming these guys are idiots if they behave the way I just described, where you refuse to take a 5% pay cut in your paycheck with prices staying the same, but you're perfectly happy to keep going to work if your paycheck stays the same and prices go up 5%, and the percentages should be a little bit different for the math purist out there. Rothbard thinks that's goofy because he says people ultimately care about the purchasing power of money, not the number of pieces of paper you're getting or whatever. But many Keynesians, including Keynes himself, thought that, no, there's actually good reasons for why unions act that way and why they will go on strike if you try to cut their pay, you know, their actual paycheck, but they don't care if the government runs a printing press. So I'm not going to go into that now. If you took me in the Keynes class, we went into it a little bit more, but I'm just warning you, just be careful. This phrase money illusion, typically free market economists use it derisively, whereas Keynesian economists are, I don't even know if they would use the term anymore, or they would just say it ironically because they don't think it's actually an illusion. Okay. Rothbard talks a little bit about the lack of a connection between so-called hoarding and movements in the interest rate. So this Rothbard comes back to this point a lot, so let me just say it in one spot here. Remember, the way Rothbard partitions things, he says, is you have money income flowing into your possession. You know, so you have money that's coming in. There's three things you can do with it. You can spend it on consumption, you can spend it on investment, or you can add it to your cash balances. So for Rothbard, that's the way he's partitioning up the world, and the three ultimate categories of decision that an individual goes through, it would be nonsensical for Rothbard to say, oh, if people start hoarding more money, that's going to do something to the interest rate, whether you think it's going to go up or down, because he's going to say it could go either way, or it could stay the same, that if people for some reason all of a sudden want to hold more cash, what that means is, compared to their previous decisions, now on the margin, as they have income coming in the door in terms of money, they divert more of it to increasing their cash balance and they spend less of it. So depending on which outlet takes the bigger proportional hit, the person's time preference might be higher or lower or the same. So the way Rothbard would view it is, if your time preference stayed the same, but your demand to hold money went up, you would apportion the hit to your spending equally among, or proportionally among, your consumption and investment spending. And that's how you would free up more money to then add to your cash balances. Whereas if you desired to hold more cash and you simultaneously had a higher time preference, then you would spend less on investment goods, and with the money you freed up, you'd add to your cash balances, but you wouldn't lower your consumption spending. Or vice versa, if you had a lower time preference and a higher demand to hold money, the way you would satisfy both of those changes is you would spend less on present consumption, and then with that money you freed up, you'd add that to your cash balances. So if everybody in the community is acting like that, you could see at the same time prices in general falling, because people are trying to hold more money, and collectively they can't do that, but they can do it in real terms if prices fall. And you might see interest rates go up or down, depending on if people's time preferences changed also. All right, let me spell out what the standard Keynesian position is on money and interest, because this was the springboard that Rothbard used to then go into his own discussion that I just told you about. So I told you Rothbard's view first to make sure you had that in your head. And now I'm going to just mention this is what the Keynesians think, and Rothbard, of course, disagrees with it. So Keynes argued that people have what's called liquidity preference. And as the name suggests, that just means other things equal, you like having assets that are liquid. So what's a liquid asset mean? It means something that you can quickly turn into cash that something you can quickly turn into its full price in cash. So a house is not very liquid, whereas a gold watch is a lot more liquid than a house. And a gold coin is even more liquid than a gold watch. So what do we mean? You could sell your house next week if you wanted to, but you'd have to charge a really low price to be sure that you get rid of it. So when we say a house is illiquid, what we usually mean is you have to search a long time to find the right buyer who's going to pay you what the house is worth, what the market price of the house is. But again, if you really needed to turn your house into cash quickly, you could do it. It's just you'd have to really lower the price. Whereas with a gold coin, especially like if it's a Krugerrand, or even better, like if it's a U.S. gold coin, you could just go to any coin shop and you're going to get whatever the market price is plus, you know, or less their margin. And it's not like it's going to be in your interest to go look at 10 different coin shops to get different quotes. I mean, you're going to get in the ballpark of what the first few people tell you right away. Whereas with your house, you got to wait long enough. So that's what liquidity means. And so the ultimate good in terms of liquidity is money. That money, almost by definition, you don't need to worry about turning it into itself. That's what it is. So even bonds, you might think that, oh, so when I talk about risky bonds in this quote here, I mean somebody might default. No, that's not what Keynes even has in mind. Even a riskless bond in the sense of default risk, even so, there's still what's called interest rate risk. So if you buy a bond for $1,000, you know, interest rates are 10%, let's say, and you buy a $1,000 bond that's gonna pay $100 a year forever. It's a perpetual bond. And so as long as interest rates stay at 10%, you can always sell that bond back for your $1,000. You can turn the bond back into cash if you want, if you needed cash for some reason. But let's say you buy the bond for $1,000. And then 6 months into it, interest rates have gone up to 20%. Well, now your bond is only worth $500. So if for some reason you had to sell your bond you'd only get $500 for it. If you can hold it, you're still going to get the $100 per year forever. Right? It's the fact that interest rates changed after you bought the bond doesn't change the coupon payments, but it changes the market value. So if you wanted to turn the bond back into cash, if you had to liquidate it, you'd take a hit. So that's why Keynes is saying people have what's called liquidity preference. Other things equal, they don't want to have their money, or their wealth, I should say, tied up in assets that have an uncertain liquidation value. And so that's the prime virtue of cash itself, money itself, is you always know exactly what its nominal value is. It's just itself. That's what it is. So what counteracts that, though? So if that's the case, why doesn't everyone hold 100% of his or her wealth in the form of just money, cash balances? Well, it's because cash doesn't pay an interest rate or doesn't have a yield, whereas stocks and bonds and other things have yields. So the way Keynes set the problem up, he's saying the higher interest rates are, the greater the penalty or the opportunity cost, if you will, from holding cash. So if I'm holding $1,000 in cash when interest rates are 10%, I'm giving up $100 a year. Because if I had turned that $1,000 of cash and used it to buy a totally safe, from a default point of view, bond that had initially a 10% rate of return, that's $100 a year I would be earning an income, interest income. But if instead I said, no, because I'm afraid if interest rates go up that I'm going to get hurt if I needed to sell that, so I'm going to keep it in the form of $1,000 cash, well, that $1,000 is going to sit there. It's not going to earn you any interest. So that's the sense in which the higher the interest rate is, the bigger the penalty on the margin from keeping your wealth in the form of cash. And so Keynes thought that liquidity preference interacted with interest rates to get people, you know, those are the things that adjusted so that people would hold collectively the amount of cash that there was in existence at that point. So another way of saying it is, if interest rates go down, then the demand to hold money goes up. And that's, if you read this stuff, that's why a lot of today's Keynesians are real big on the fact that the Fed right now is what they call pushing on a string, that just going into the market and doing open market operations and quantitative easing doesn't have that much of an effect when interest rates are already at zero. Because the Fed is just, like, let's say the Fed comes in and buys another $1 trillion worth of short-term government bonds, the Keynesians are going to say, yeah, you nutjob Ron Paul types are worried about, ooh, there's inflation, blah, blah. But we Keynesians realize that's basically a neutral transaction, that the Fed has just taken $1 trillion worth of dollar-denominated assets that yield basically no interest income, taking them away from the banks, and then giving them $1 trillion worth of dollar-denominated assets that yield 0% income, namely cash. So you haven't really changed the economy much. You've just done a tiny little change. Whereas the Austrians are like, oh, the monetary base went up by $1 trillion. All right, so that's the Keynesian view with this stuff. Okay, again, I think it's probably going to be next week's material is where Rothbard is going to go through and unload on Keynesianism, but right now we're just sort of getting warmed up where he just introduces some of these things. All right. Topic 7 here. Now, this is a little bit tricky, so let me just make sure you understand what Rothbard's talking about. It's the purchasing power component of the market interest rate or the loan interest rate or the contractual interest rate. So here, remember, Austrians, in the tradition of Bombavrk and onward, think of the originary or the natural rate of interest, meaning the rate of interest that's manifested in terms of entrepreneurs buying producer goods, transforming them into something that they then sell in the future, and then the spread on those transactions is what constitutes the interest income to those investors or those entrepreneurs. They typically don't think of the interest rate as being set in the loan market where people are borrowing and lending dollars or units of money. Whereas just about every other economist or school of thought, when they think of interest rates, think of it in terms of if I want to go borrow units of money, what's the price per unit I have to pay per unit of time? So Irving Fisher, who is just a giant in neoclassical economics and specifically Chicago School of Monetarism, he came up with what's called now the Fisher relation, which says that when there are changes, when there are expected changes in the purchasing power of money, that gets built into the standard loan contract. So if suppose the purchasing power of money were going to be constant and people's time preferences led them that in equilibrium the interest rate were 5%, so someone lends out $100 today, they want to get $105 back next year, just because of impatience, time preference, the fact that consuming sooner rather than later is preferred. So, oh, gee, if I have to wait a year, you know, I'm going to need to be compensated. That's the idea. But now, what if on top of that, prices in general are going to be higher next year than they are right now when I'm lending you this $100? I need to be compensated for that also. Because so maybe I need to get paid back $110 to compensate me both for the fact that I'm getting paid back in weaker dollars and that I had to wait a year. So usually the way people do it is they just add the two together. So they'll say, oh, if the real interest rate is 3% and the expected price inflation rate is 5%, then the actual loan rate of interest is 8%. Strictly speaking, that's not right, just in terms of if you do the math, you know, like with exponentials, that's not, that you can't just add the two numbers together. It's a little bit off. I mean, with low numbers, it's fine as an approximation, but I'm just, for purists out there, I'm just warning you that technically, if you do the formula, it doesn't, you don't just literally add them up. You're multiplying 1.03 times 1.05 or something like that, and it's not quite the same thing. Okay, now, so I'm just setting up the context there. That's what everybody else would think of if you talked about purchasing power of interest rate or component in the contractual rate of interest. And then it would also go the other way, too, that suppose the real rate of interest is 5%, but people expect prices in general to go down by 2%. Well, then I think most economists would say, oh, so in that case, the contractual loan rate of interest is only going to be 3% or thereabouts, because you're happy to give up $100 today and only get $103 back next year because prices are going to go down 2% or whatever I said. So you're getting paid back in stronger dollars, and so that's why you're willing to tolerate a lower contractual rate of interest. So the idea is you've got the real rate based on time preference, and then you adjust it for a component based on what's going to happen to the purchasing power of money in the interim. Now, the thing that's weird is what happens if price deflation, expected price deflation, is so big that it would push the nominal interest rate negative. So, for example, if time preferences are such that, you know, normally the real rate of interest should be 5%, but we expect price deflation of 8%, so you might think, oh, so that means the actual nominal interest rate ought to be negative 3%. But that doesn't make any sense. Why would anybody lend out $100 today to get paid back $97 next year? You would just sit on your $100 and then have $100 next year. You would never lend out at a negative market rate of interest under normal circumstances. So Fisher and the people in that tradition kind of just said, well, yeah, that's just a weird, quirky thing about money. And so just that's why weird stuff can happen when nominal interest rates butt up against the 0% lower bound. And in fact, that plays a big role in the Keynesian analysis of what's going on right now. As they're saying, the actual, you know, the market clearing interest rate wants to be negative, but it can't be. And so that's why we're stuck. Okay, so Rothbard totally rejects all this. And he says that if you expected these changes in the purchasing power of money, then speculation would already speed it up and it would already be here. So he says, for example, if in the way he tries to show the superiority of his approach is he's saying, I don't care about the 0% lower bound. That's not a problem for me. That let's say normally the time preference thing would be 5%. So normally somebody would buy producer goods at $100 and then transform them over the course of a year into consumer goods that he sells to his customers for $105. And he's happy earning that 5% return on his invested capital. And then now, though, he expects a 50% fall in prices. So the stuff that he normally would sell for $105, actually he's only going to be able to sell for $52.5. next year. So what will you do now? Well, clearly Robert says he would just, the price of producer goods would collapse. The stuff that before he would have been willing to pay 100 for, now he's only going to be willing to pay whatever 0.95 times 52.5 is, right? So he's going to charge, he's going to pay for those producer goods right now such that he gets a 5% return on his money going in the next period when he sells the finished products for 52.5. So that's Rothbard's point, that when you think, forget the contractual loan market, if you think of it in terms of producers buying and selling producer goods with the expectation of selling the outputs, the prices would adjust immediately. And there wouldn't be this issue of a 0% lower bound, that wouldn't even come into play. So the reason I say that's weird is, I can't argue with his logic there, but it just seems like the Fisher relation works pretty well in many contexts. So for example, when price inflation was really high in the U.S. in the late 70s and early 80s, interest rates were high also. And I don't just mean when they jacked them up when Volcker came in. I mean, even before that. And so it seemed, and when you look around the world, like in the Weimar Republic, when there was the hyperinflation, there were periods when interest rates were really high. And that actually confused some of the Keynesians. Like Joan Robinson thought that the German bank was instituting tight money. Because she was saying at the time, look at how high their interest rates are. It can't be that the German central bank is fueling the incredible price inflation we're seeing in interwar Germany, because look at how high interest rates are. And everybody knows high interest rates are a sign of tight money. But the point is, given what the price inflation rate was, the interest rates were ridiculously low. So like if interest rates were 200%, but prices in general were rising at 10,000%, then those are actually rock bottom interest rates in real terms. So that's the idea. So I'm not sure. I kind of have to think about it some more. But my point is, I'm explaining to you what Rothbard's argument is here. But yet, I can't point out what's wrong with it, if anything. But it still seems like the Fisher relation explains a lot in the real world, and I don't know how to use Rothbard's suggested alternative for those kind of situations. Okay, let's see how much time we got. Okay, banks serving as money warehouses and credit intermediaries. A lot of you took my course on the Federal Reserve, and so I'm not going to go over a lot of this stuff here in too much detail, but in case some of you didn't, let me just give you the very big picture basics. Rothbard believes in 100% reserve banking, and he doesn't like fractional reserve banking. He thinks it's fraudulent. So the way – there's two functions that banks can serve. They can either be money warehouses, where they just store your money as a convenience to you, so you can write checks on it, use a debit card, you're not going to get mugged, that kind of thing. Or they can serve as credit intermediaries where you're lending your money to the bank and then it in turn lends it to somebody else. So it's ultimately just connecting you, the saver, with some borrower in the community, and the bank serves as middleman. So those are two distinct functions, and Rothbard thinks that in practice, fraction reserve banking merges them so that we have absurdities where you get paid interest on a checking account, when, if anything, you should be paying the bank to store your money so you can walk around and write checks on it. Because what happens in practice is the bank takes your money that's on deposit that you think is still yours, and they lend it out, which strikes Rothbard as crazy. It's like a storage warehouse where college students put their furniture during the summer when they move out of the dorms, but they don't want to take all their couches and lava lamps and posters of heavy metal groups home with them to their parents' house, so they just put it in storage. They rent a locker. And then if they found out that the owner of that place would open up the lockers and take out the couches and rent them out to people and just say, oh, well, I think I'm going to have it back before you guys get back into town for school, and don't worry, whenever you show up and want your couch, I'll have it for you, but in the meantime, I'll make some more money by renting it out to people. That would be crazy. So Rothbard thinks, by the same token, when you deposit your money in what's called a demand deposit account at a bank, just think of like a checking account, they shouldn't then go take your money and lend it out to somebody else who's going to go buy a house with it. That's crazy. And it's no good to say, oh, no, if we run our business properly on any given day, any customer who shows up and wants to withdraw his money, we'll have some money there to give it to him. Rothbard thinks that's nuts. So here is, and I, in today's lecture, I'm not going to be able to get into all that stuff. I think probably Rothbard will elaborate on it when he talks about the business cycle in chapter 12. So we'll postpone most of it for there. But let me now just explain to you how these balance sheets work. Incidentally, if you really like this stuff and you want to see more of it, I have a video called, I think it's called The Theory of Central Banking, something like that. It's a Mises thing, but it's on YouTube. If you go and Google Robert Murphy, The Theory of Central Banking, I think it should be one of the top hits. And it's one of my lectures from the Fed class where I go through the mechanics of, it might even be called The Mechanics of Central Banking, now that I think of it, where I really step-by-step go through the accounting of fractional reserve banking, if you really care about that stuff. But here, let me just give you the big picture. So you've got a balance sheet, you got your assets on the left side, and on the right side, you got your liabilities and capital. Another term for capital would be shareholder equity. So the equation in terms of the accounting is assets equal liabilities plus equity, or liabilities plus capital. So it's double entry bookkeeping. It's always got to be the case that this number over here equals this number here. So how does it work? This is 100% reserve bank. The idea is originally the owners of the bank kicked in 100 ounces of gold. Maybe it was 20 guys and they each kicked in 5 ounces. Maybe it was 5 women and they each kicked in 20 ounces, whatever. Collectively, the shareholders or the owners of this bank kicked in 100 ounces of gold, and they used it to buy some equipment like a safe and maybe a video camera in case they get robbed, so they can have video to show the police, and bars in front of the teller windows to keep them safe, and bathrooms and stuff like that. So the 100 ounces of gold they used to buy the building and to buy the land, whatever, of the bank itself. And then they also now are going to just have checking accounts for their customers. So their customers come in and deposit 5,000 ounces of gold into the bank, and then the bank gives them checkbooks, and they can go around town and write checks on it. And so the bank's service, its job, is just to store those 5,000 ounces safely. Maybe they have armed guards or something. They have a nice big vault. And then they process the checks. When you write a check to a merchant, the merchant sends it to you, the bank, and then, or to your bank, and then the bank takes it and transfers the money, you know, in their ledger from your account, the customer, to the store's account, and so forth. So that's a perfectly legitimate business, and they would charge you some, you know, maybe a fee or a percentage based on every check you wrote or whatever. That's how they do their money. But in terms of the bookkeeping right up front, this is all they would do. They would have to keep that gold in the vault so that these warehouse receipts that they had issued, which would either be checkbook deposits or bank notes, like pieces of paper saying the bearer of this note can take it to any Acme branch location and get 10 ounces of gold. So maybe they printed up 50 of the, or 500 of those pieces of paper and handed them out to their customers when they gave them the physical gold. So those are all backed up one for one. And this is a perfectly legitimate thing. And so you add up the assets. There's 5,000 ounces of gold in the vault. There's 100 ounces of gold worth of equipment that's on the premises and the building itself. That's 5,100 ounces. In terms of the liabilities and capital, well, the shareholders have 100 ounces of equity in the building or in the business. And they've got now floating around the community 5,000 ounces of gold worth of these pieces of paper that are claimed on the bank, saying the bearer of this note can turn this into the bank and get such and such number of ounces of gold redeemed. So the bank has to be, I mean, those things are floating around and they're legally binding. The bank can't just ignore those things. Those are legitimate claims against them. All right, but what if now they're a fractional reserve bank? So they've been in business for a long time and they realize, you know, nobody ever, or very few people on any given day come into our branches and turn over those pieces of paper, those warehouse receipts, and say, give me the actual metal, the yellow metal gold coins. So why don't we, instead of keeping, so why don't we issue another 1,000 of those warehouse receipts? I guess that's what they did here. They didn't actually lend out the physical gold. They just printed up 1,000 more notes and lent them out. So, you know, somebody wants to buy a new house, and the bank says, how much does it cost? And they say, oh, it costs 100 ounces of gold. So they go and they just print up a note that says, if you present this bank note to Acme Bank, we'll give you 100 ounces of gold. And they go and give it to the guy, and they say, okay, we'll lend you this at 6% interest. It's a mortgage. The guy says, okay. So they write that down. Now that IOU, that guy owes the bank 100 ounces of gold plus some interest, you know, a year from now. And then he takes that piece of paper and goes and buys a house with it. You know, he goes and gives it to the developer, and that guy thinks it's as good as money because those things have been circulating in the community, and it's a hassle. You don't actually want to go walk to the bank and turn it over and get the gold. Now everyone in the community takes those pieces of paper that Acme Bank prints up and treats them as if they're as good as physical gold. So now Acme Bank is a counterfeiter. It can just print those things up and lend them out to people, and they can go buy real stuff with it. So in terms of the accounting, the way this happens is Rothbard says the moment after they first print up those 1,000 ounces worth of new banknotes and lend them out to people, this is what their books look like. They've got the gold in the vault still. They've still got the equipment, but now they have 1,000 ounces worth of IOUs from people in the community that have borrowed those things from the bank. And so those are assets. Those people owe that money to the bank, and there's actually going to be interest attached to those, but right now the market value is 1,000 ounces because time needs to elapse before the interest accrues. But then on the liability side, now there's 6,000 ounces worth of those paper tickets floating around because they printed up an extra 1,000. And so they're liable. And so now, and notice too, the 6,100 ounces adds up to 6,100 ounces. So the books still balance. So the fractional reserve bank is not insolvent, but now it's illiquid. Now it's vulnerable to a bank run. If for some reason the public begins to doubt the ability of this bank to redeem its notes and everybody shows up at the same time and tries to turn in all 6,000 of these notes, the bank can't do it because they've only got 5,000 in the vault. Okay. Let me see what I got to do here. Actually, let me just go. These last two things are pretty quick, so I'll go over them fast. The Rothbard says that the law of one price, we talked about that with regard to, hang on, my phone was going crazy, so I just want to make sure. Okay. I had my son staying somewhere. I just want to make sure they weren't calling me. The law of one price, remember, that applies to a regular good. The like apples, okay. What's the law of one price mean with regard to apples? That, well, it can't be the case that the same apple, economically speaking, is selling on this side of the street for $2 and selling on the other side of the street for $3 a pound. That can't last unless there's some institutional barrier, because arbitragers would come in and buy it at $2 and walk across the street and sell it at $3. And then by so doing, they would push up the price of $2 and push down the price of $3 until, not necessarily until they're equal, but until it no longer was worth anybody's while to physically transport the apples. Now, there could be differences, like if they're actually different apples, if for some reason the people get more enjoyment from eating them in one spot than the other, you know, there's stuff like that that can come into play, but that's what the law of one price means. So Rothbard says that applies to money as much as to anything else. So what that means is there's a uniform purchasing power of money across the whole world for any given type of money. That gold has to have the same purchasing power everywhere, absent government interventions, and also giving a due allowance for transport costs. So the thing that, you know, that people might say when they first hear a claim like that is, like, what are you talking about? Everybody knows the so-called cost of living is a lot higher in, say, Manhattan than it is in Boise. Boise is a real little town, in case foreigners don't know what that is. So clearly, wouldn't you say the purchasing power of money is lower in Manhattan than in Boise or in some other small little town? You know, isn't it correct to say your money goes farther in Boise than it does in Manhattan, or money doesn't get you very much in Manhattan? You need a lot of money to get anything in Manhattan because money's purchasing power is real low. People might loosely speak like that, but Rothbard says, no, economically that doesn't make any sense. That if it were true, if it were actually true that money had a lower purchasing power in Manhattan than in Boise, then why aren't arbitragers stepping in? Why aren't they selling money in Boise and buying money in Manhattan? Meaning, why aren't they selling things in Manhattan and buying them in Boise? And then you start to see, well, okay, so part of it's transportation costs. If it really is the case that like a six-pack of beer is cheaper in Boise than in Manhattan, you'd say, okay, well, why don't people then go and buy the beer in Boise and ship it into Manhattan? And there's lots of different reasons. Part of it is I'm sure there's government regulations and liquor licenses and that kind of stuff. So that's part of it. But also, too, just that, the land is very expensive in Manhattan. And so it'd be hard for you, you know, if you're going to set up a convenience store to pay the rent. And you keep pushing that analysis and saying, so is that a cost theory of value? And no, it's not. Ultimately, the reason is that people, there are things in Manhattan that the consumers enjoy more than in Boise. So you're willing to pay more to live in Manhattan as a consumer, as an individual, just because you like being in Manhattan. And you want to go see a Broadway show. And you could say, what does it cost to see the equivalent Broadway show in Boise? And there is no answer. Cost infinity. Because you can't go see an actual Broadway show in Boise. You can only see it in Manhattan. And what is it? How much would you have to pay in Boise to live down the street from the Empire State Building? There is no such price. You can't get that in Boise. Right? So that's what Rothbard, how he deals with that sort of issue there, that he's saying actually the purchasing power is the same, it's that these are different goods. Okay, and then the last thing for tonight's lecture, and then I'll see if I can answer one or two of your questions, is what's called a purchasing power parity principle for a fourth P there. If you here we're talking about having different monies. So remember, we don't know how many monies would exist. We know what the definition of money is. It's a medium of exchange that's commonly accepted. There's nothing saying there can only be one such thing among a group of people. Historically, gold and silver would exist as money even among the same populations. So whether you're talking about that or whether you're talking about money that's money for one group of people and then money that's money for somebody else, and that there's just a little bit of an overlap with some, you know, currency traders that have both on hand, the question is, what determines the unit price of one currency or one money and quoted in terms of the other? And so the answer is purchasing power parity, that it's got to be the case in equilibrium that there's no advantage to buying something in one money and selling it in another money and then going back, like, and then converting the money into the other one. So, for example, if a barrel of oil has a market price right now of 100 euros and it has a market price of $120, well, then it has to be the case that in the foreign exchange markets, 1 euro trades for $1.20. Because if it didn't, let's say 1 euro traded for $1, what would happen? People would they would take 120 euros, they would buy, or would they take, no, I'm sorry, they would take 100 euros, they would buy a barrel of oil with it, then they would sell the barrel of oil for $120, and then they would take the $120 and get 120 euros. If the euro and dollar sold, or, you know, traded one for one. And so they would, the person who did that thing would start out with 100 euros and would end up with 120 euros just by going through that string of transactions. And so, you know, he would have increased how many euros he had basically risk-free if he could lock in those prices. So him doing that, you know, remember, one, what is he doing there? He's buying oil that's quoted in euros, selling oil that's quoted in dollars, and then using dollars to buy euros. Those were the three things I said he had to do. So if you think through the implications of those things, they would attack those margins that I had there along the arbitrage. It would push up the euro price of oil, it would push down the dollar price of oil, and it would push up the dollar price of a euro. And so in equilibrium, for that arbitrage activity to stop, it would have to be the case that the dollar-euro exchange rate made you indifferent buying and selling oil in either currency. So don't take this principle too far. Some people, when they see this, they think that, oh, that means all prices everywhere on the planet instantly adjust, and that nobody ever cares about, or the currency movements never can give any impetus to exports or imports. And that's not true. And that's why I have here in parentheses, at least among tradable goods. In order for this argument to work, it's got to be something that's pretty fungible, and that the two regions that use the different monies can pretty cheaply ship back and forth. So the reason a barrel of oil is a good example is because plenty of places that use euros and dollars import oil. And so it wouldn't be too hard to do the sort of arbitrage action that I said if that discrepancy were big enough. Whereas haircuts, it would be a lot more, you couldn't be as sure about what the euro and the dollar would do if the only discrepancy were not in terms of barrels of oil, but in terms of haircuts. That, you get what I'm saying? That if I said, oh, if a haircut costs this much in Paris, but this much in Boise, well then, the dollar or euro exchange rate would have to change, because otherwise, that wouldn't even make sense, because you can't import and export haircuts. or at least not very easily. So just keep that in mind. So I had an article, I'm not going to remember the title. I'll try to post it in the forum if I remember, where I was going over this issue about could the central bank give your economy a temporary advantage in exports by debasing the currency. From this purchasing power parity argument, you might think initially, well, no, if the Fed, you know, makes the dollar fall in half, that would just make all prices double. And so there would be no, and that's not quite right. It doesn't happen. Some goods respond more quickly than others, in particular goods that are traded internationally. So there is an issue there, but still everything on this slide is true, that the way you would pin down the exchange rate between currencies would involve making sure there's no arbitrage opportunities among goods that both currencies can easily trade against. Okay, let me, just for like the next 4 minutes, see if I can answer one question from the from forum, but then I gotta end because, I have my son. Is it a drop in the center? I have to go get him. Okay, finally, it's loading up right now. Sorry, I went to the wrong week. Incidentally, the reason I can't just leave this loaded up is that it kicks me out. In case you're wondering why I don't just open up these things before the lecture every week. Okay. Okay, lots of questions. I'm trying to find a real short one. Okay, James says, the yield curve inversion is generally indicative of a pending recession. Given the Fed's Operation Twist is designed to distort the yield curve, if a recession were due, would Operation Twist conceal this diagnostic, or would the results pop up like whack-a-mole elsewhere? And if so, where, in other words, where should we be looking? Okay, that's a good question. So what James is getting at, the yield curve means if you plot on the x-axis the maturities and then the y-axis is the yield. So I'm just going to see from your point of view, yeah, like this, if I did it right, is what it would look like, would be a normal yield curve, so that as you get longer and longer, so the interest rate on a 1 month bond would be low, the interest rate on a 3 month bond would be higher, the interest rate on a 5 year bond would be longer, a 10 year, a 30 year, like, so the annualized interest rate gets higher and higher the longer you're locking your money up, as it were. And the conventional explanation for that is that Keynesian thing about liquidity preference, that if you're going to tie your money up for a longer period, other things equal, you're going to want to be earning a higher yield to compensate for that extra risk. Remember, at any time, you can sell a bond. If you buy a 30-year bond, and then next week you lose your job and you need cash, you're allowed to go sell it in the secondary market. But the point is, you might take a huge hit, that you might only get a small amount back of what you paid for that bond if interest rates have gone up in the meantime. And the longer the maturity, the more sensitive the market price of the bond is to changes in interest rates. So if you bought a 1 year bond, and you paid $1,000 for it, and your buddy bought a 30-year bond and paid $1,000 for it, and then interest rates went up 2 percentage points, and you both sold your bonds, you're going to get most of your money back, whereas your buddy is going to get killed in percentage terms. If interest rates originally were like 3%, let's say, on both of them. All right, so that's what a normal yield curve looks like. So an inverted yield curve means it's the opposite, as the name suggests, when short-term rates are higher than long-term rates. And so that's considered weird. So the interesting thing is, historically, at least in the post-World War II era, inverted yield curves had this uncanny ability to signal that there's going to be a recession. That every time there's been an inverted yield curve, there's been a recession shortly thereafter. And every time there's been a recession, if you looked beforehand, you would see, oh yeah, the yield curve inverted. So you got to define those terms carefully. What do you mean shortly thereafter, and what do you mean by inverted, and what bonds are you using, and that kind of stuff. But there really is something there. It's not just some weird invention of economists who are trying to see patterns. There really is this phenomenon that needs to be explained. So anyway, I tried to explain. I think that's a natural outgrowth of Austrian business cycle theory. That when there's a boom, think about it, when there's an inflationary boom, what's going to happen is the Fed floods the credit markets with money, pushing down interest rates. That's going to tend to push down short-term rates more than long-term rates, because if the Fed's printing more money, that tends to raise inflation expectations. So here I'm relying on that Fisher relation that Rothbard cast some doubt upon. So I think, you know, the Fed, if it wants to come in and create trillions of dollars and start buying bonds, it can push down short-term interest rates. But if people think that, oh, man, that's going to push up prices, probably they're not going to lend 30 years at a real low interest rate, because they're thinking prices are going to be so much higher 30 years from now. So during the inflationary boom, you might expect to see short rates way down and longer rates going higher, so the normal, so-called normal yield curve. But then when the Fed puts on the brakes and tightens, what happens? Short rates spike up, and then long rates might even fall, both because the economy is now going into recession, or people think it might, so returns are lower, and because now price inflation expectations are lower because the Fed's tightening. And so I think, like, if you think in just terms of the normal necessity and explanation of the boom-bust cycle, and then you ask yourself, what would the yield curve look like along that history? I think you would see, oh, during the boom, it would be a normal yield curve, and then right before they go into the bust, it would invert. So James now is asking, does an Operation Twist change that? And what does Operation Twist do? I think it's the other way around, James, isn't it? Doesn't Operation Twist try to push down long-term yields by selling short-term bonds? So Operation Twist, if successful, would push down long-term rates and make short rates go up, pushing the yield curve more towards inversion. So if it were the other way around, I get what you're saying. You're saying, is the yield curve supposed to be inverted, but Operation Twist is hiding it? But I think it's the other way around, unless I'm getting mixed up. I think Operation Twist, if anything, would be taking a normal yield curve and making it look inverted. That's the quick answer, and we got to stop there. Okay, thanks, everybody. I will send out an email about your quiz being posted and what the office hours will be for this Saturday. If I don't see you then, try to do your reading for next week. So long.